then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 7th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, I'm going to start out this week with what's basically some housekeeping, kind of Hateful Harold's Handy Hints for Heretics. I may start making this a regular feature on RFN in the future. I got an email from Devon in Michigan. Dear HAC, will getting a post office box help my migration process, or is it wasting money? Is it bad juju to mix white nationalist political PO boxes with business mail, or is that paranoia? All right. Basically, Devon, your answer is yes, it's a good idea. Let's talk about mail stuff for a while. Now, I know this is the 21st century, and everybody communicates by email, cell phone, and text. From the revelations of Edward Snowden, we now know for sure, if we didn't know already before that, that every electronic communication of that kind sent in this country, and most likely throughout the whole Western world, is intercepted and archived in huge computer databases in Utah and West Virginia by the National Security Agency, and then made accessible to all the multifarious secret police organizations in the government's alphabet soup, as well as foreign secret police and spy agencies such as New Scotland Yard, the RCMP, the Mossad, so forth and so on. The only way for white racial heretics, or anybody for that matter, to communicate with one another with any remote degree of privacy is to fall back on paper mail, which is one reason I think that there are already rumblings on the Lefty Lib blogs about abolishing the post office altogether for letters and making it purely a kind of government-run UPS or FedEx for parcels only. Slowly but surely, the tentacles of the dictatorship's octopus are closing around the last vestiges of freedom and privacy remaining in America, and I'll talk about that more in a little bit. Me, I like the idea of making those lazy-ass FBI agents put down their $7 lattes and get their expensively upholstered taxpayer-fed asses up out of their cubicles and making them drive through traffic down to the post office to do a good old-fashioned J. Edgar-style mail cover, if any of them remember how. Although I have heard that the G-men have now gotten too lazy to do their own mail covers, they're getting the postal inspectors to steal the mail and open it and fluoroscope it for them now. I'll be honest, there have been times over the past few years that I've sat down and given very serious thought to getting the NF off the internet entirely and going back to paper and postage stamp. But aside from the ruinous expense involved in paying 49 cents per letter for what I can send for free by thousands of emails, it can't be done. This is the year 2015, and the clock of history always runs forward and never back. Like it or not, this is the world we live in, and one of the basic facts of life that every white man and woman who decides that they're going to offer even some token resistance to this evil tyranny has to understand and accept is that today we live in a goldfish bowl. And that when you begin to make racial comments on Stormfront or blog comment sections, or you visit racial websites, in very short order, the secret police will know who you are and where you live. You cannot hide. From now on, that is a given. If you think forbidden thoughts, they are going to find out and you are going in their databases. There is no escape. Screw your courage to the sticking point, as Shakespeare wrote, and learn to accept this truth, or else don't bother. Run away and hide in your closet, trembling in terror like a wee little mouse, which is what they want you to do. Which is why they do all this. They don't do it to stop terrorism, but to commit it. To terrorize you into silence. Now, every white nationalist, wherever they live, needs a secure mailing address, by which I mean a mailing address where you and you alone collect the mail, and where no hostiles living with you, be they parents or spouse or roommates or dumbass liberal kids or whoever, can spy on you and observe who you are receiving mail from, and possibly use that knowledge to harass and annoy you, to punish you for being different or do you harm in some way. And yes, it happens. It's happened to me. Such as ratting you out as a heretic to the secret police or the media or some authority figure with petty power like a landlord or employer who has the capability to do you harm for your wicked evil thoughts and for daring to receive mail from people like me who think wicked evil thoughts. And if you're not willing to incur at least a small amount of that risk in order to be free and in order to do what is right, then you don't deserve to be free. Now, if you live on your own, or if you're the head of your household for real, and you actually make decisions in the home, which is increasingly rare for white males, or if you are one of the shrinking number of white people who still own your own home with a mortgage and you don't have to worry about a landlord, then congratulations. However, it is still advisable to pay the $150 or so per year for a post office box or a UPS store or other private mailbox so that your home address does not appear on your correspondence mailing lists, which are also vulnerable. And so that address doesn't fall into the hands of the secret police if your correspondence get raided. Yes, I know I've just finished telling you that they're going to find out where you live anyway, but guys, let's make them do some work. Let's not just hand them everything on a silver platter. Let's practice a little bit of security protocol here. If you genuinely have a job or a family to protect, there is no shame and a lot of sense in using a mail drop like a P.O. box and also using a false name. I get that. Remember, security consciousness helps you function as a nationalist and a revolutionary. Paranoia prevents you from functioning. That's how you tell the difference. Now, I have a mailing list for Northwest Observer. I have to use one because I don't have a photographic memory. I take certain precautions to conceal it, and I'll be taking more as soon as I can claw back some quiet time to sit down and figure out how the new NF-NPA dichotomy is going to roll. But there is always the chance that it will be seized by the dictatorship, either using the law or through various extra-legal means, and you guys just have to accept that because there's not a damn thing any of us can do about it. Burn this into your brain. If you think bad thoughts one way or another, they are going to find out who you are and where you live. This is life in a third world dictatorship. If we didn't want this to happen, we should have taken the guns out of the closet back in 1957 when Eisenhower ordered the federal troops into Little Rock. We didn't fight then, we won't fight now, and we have to live with the consequences of our cowardice and our weakness. It just is what it is, and the only alternative is cowering in fear in your homes and shitting in your pants every time there's a knock on your door. They will continue to bully us and terrorize us until we stop them. And if we don't stop them, eventually they're going to kill us all. Okay, back to the subject of post office boxes. I'm really rambling on this one. You can tell I actually didn't write a script for this. But actually, this is a bit on topic because while I myself have not attempted to rent a post office box for many years now, a friend of ours did recently, and he was horrified by all the hoops that you have to jump through these days. Now, I don't know if this is true of every post office in the land, but he sent me a photocopy of the form that they gave him at his local post office, and the ID and the documentation you have to produce these days just to rent a box stunned me. Apparently, you now not only have to show a driver's license, but in order to prove your physical home address, you have to produce your home documents, either your mortgage papers or your lease, and the two addresses have to match. Now, as I read this, even a utility bill isn't good enough anymore. It has to be some kind of legal document stating that you live at such and such an address. Apparently, since the current dictator came to power in 2009, the regime has been tightening the screws and creating a national database of everybody's home addresses, among other sneaky backdoor methods, by using the post office. So it may be that there actually are some grounds for our people to be afraid of the mailman. Bluntly, this is so both the secret police and the blue coat muscle street police know where to lay hands on you, literally speaking. They want to know which door to kick in when they come for you. It is extremely embarrassing to the cops when they kick in the wrong door and throw flashbangs into cribs containing two-year-olds, as recently happened. Now, most private mailboxes aren't quite that bad, I don't think. A driver's license will usually do, but also bear in mind that private mailboxes have a tendency to go out of business overnight. Now, one more thing on private mailboxes. Devin, you asked about mixing business mail with white nationalist mail. Not entirely sure what you mean there, but one thing I have been informed about private mailbox services like UPS Store and so forth. Of late, the state and local tax people, and maybe the IRS as well, are zeroing in on them, and if you open the box in the name of a business, they're demanding business license numbers and tax ID numbers. This is more economic than law enforcement related, since state and local governments that collect sales tax and whatnot are starving to death all across the country for tax revenues of any kind from anywhere. Now, with 95 million adults not working in America, basically nobody's paying taxes anymore, and they are really getting hysterical, and they are going to do anything they can to drain money from anywhere. And a lot of people, of course, use these private mailbox services to run little side businesses, and basically the tax people are trying to get their fangs into those. Okay, even at the beginning, I can tell this one's going to run way, way long this week. So here's Gretchen.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I would like to discuss The Lie of Apartheid by Arthur Kemp. Arthur Kemp was born in South Africa of English parents, and he was drafted into the South African police, and he later joined the Conservative Party. One of the little dark humor jokes that you'll find in this book, really the only one, is the question, what defines a white South African? And the answer is someone who would rather be murdered in bed than make a bed. So this book is really going to focus on the fatal era that was made in South Africa, and that is the attempt at supremacy rather than separatism. Now, how did this mistake come about with regard to Afrikaners? In the case of the Afrikaners, it seems that the Christian religion played a role. In 1838, the Boers defeated the Zulus due to just better technology on the part of the Boers. However, the Calvinist Afrikaners saw this as an example of Christianity triumphing over heathenry, and they constructed a small church called the Church of the Vow. Ironically, this church now stands, if it still stands to this day, I don't know, in a 95% black area. However, despite this type of a defeat, I guess you could say, most Afrikaners remain Christian, and many of them, at least at the time this book was written, or traditionally, they belong to the Dutch Reformed Church. For many decades, this church tended to support a supremacist viewpoint, and it tended to encourage a view that Africans were similar to children. However, apparently this church had a colored section, and in the 70s, its colored section adopted something called the Belhar Declaration. And the declaration declared apartheid to be unbiblical and a sin. And eventually this view spread to the mainstream Dutch Reformed Church. Quite naturally, many members of the National Party were also members of this DRC. Now, this goes a long way to explain how Botha abolished past laws and the miscegenation laws, and also how a new constitution was adopted to include mixed race and Asian Indians in parliament. Another thing that this attachment to Christianity explains It explains the 46% of Afrikaners that voted for anti-apartheid reform when the question was put to a national referendum. However, even with all of this church influence, it should be noted that 54% of Afrikaners voted against reform. In any event, the system was really doomed. But in any case, the other thing that happened was that in the case of the English, 96% voted for reform. So the question with them is, why did so many English do this? Well, for one reason, the English really tended to dislike the Afrikaners, and they tended to associate apartheid with Afrikaner culture. The other thing was that the English tended to be less rooted in Africa, and in fact, 1.5 million of English-speaking whites actually ended up leaving Africa. At any rate, one of the things that Kemp really stresses was that the system was unsustainable even if whites had voted against reform, because the mistake was really so systematic. The South African whites, well, particularly the Afrikaners, really wanted to use blacks as tools that could do a job and then be quietly put away. In the 70s, you did have something called Grand Apartheid that was a program which gave prime agricultural land over to the traditional tribal Africans, and it would hope that this would satisfy the blacks. The problem was that a great many of the blacks worked in white areas, and this tended to force them into shanty towns. But even in these cases, and perhaps especially in those cases, they had the benefit of Western culture. One really great example of this is a hospital in Soweto for blacks. So here was this Western hospital built by either pious or guilty whites, and I can just imagine what happened. The hospital did many things, I'm sure, to help blacks, but the most ominous, I'm sure, was all the prenatal care and the birthing care, which I'm sure was lavished on these frequently pregnant native women. When you imagine this pattern repeated, you can see how numbers really began to grow. At this point, the whites needed a military and police force for containment. So basically, you had 5 million whites, 800,000 of those would be males of military age, and you'd have to divide that between the military and the police. You've got to understand there are also, in addition to the many blacks, there's going to be mixed race and Asian Indians. So really the question was when, not if, because the mistake was made so early on in the establishment of South African culture. What Afrikaners, and really all whites at the end of the day in South Africa, failed to understand, or at least not enough understood, was that geographic power really is about numbers, and they did not adjust their behavior for a realistic strategy. Only this type of adjustment may save you from third world extermination. Kemp really stresses this iron law of demographic numbers and how they set direction of a society. So how do you know if an individual or a group has come to understand this numbers issue? Well, first of all, they stop wasting their time with crackpot conspiracy theories. These ideas rest on a foundation of fictions, and even more to the point, they are irrelevant. They stop with the party politics in a majority rule system, and they start to create a territory where they can actually form a demographic majority. They make sure to do their own labor. In the case of South Africa, this eventually became Orana. Now, of course, that's still imperfect because Orana is vulnerable to court rulings and possible encroachment. And recently, I was very upset to hear that a court had ruled that it is illegal to bar blacks from Orana. However, the culture, the language, and the remoteness of Arana would tend to mitigate against too much of a severity of that kind of problem. So, at any rate, within the Conservative Party, this idea of a new state or territory caused a split. And eventually, Kemp was barred from the CP. One of the predictions that Kemp makes in this book with regard to the AWB, which was an even more radical Afrikaner branch, Kemp predicted they were somewhat paper tigers, unfortunately, and that most would not fight and that a lot of others would be arrested. I'll probably go into specifics of AWB at a later date. Eventually, Kemp decided to move to England, as he was the child of English parents, and it is understandable that he would want to leave the chaos and deteriorating situation behind him. Now, I would highly recommend this book. I've really become quite enamored of Arthur Kemp, and I'm going to talk more about his writings later on. So I thank you very much for listening. And again, you can see that I'm very much in the Savetri Devi camp, I should say, when it comes to my Indic sympathies. But at any rate, I thank you for listening, comrades, and hail victory.
Okay, strikes me we haven't had a good old-fashioned Southern murder ballad on here for a while. This is Kenny Rogers.
As I'm walking behind this plow, I keep turning over memories, buried treasure of a past once filled with you. Old ground, I know it's mine, and I've worked it so many times, and the rain it's been praying for is falling from my eyes, waiting for the setting sun. When a hard day's work is done, we'd sit down and rock the baby, plan our dreams. But you turned it all around with this other man you found, and you never thought I'd figure out your scheme. And there's buried treasure hidden in the ground, precious memories of a love that lived and died. Couldn't be the simple wife, you had to lead the cheating life, and you led me down a road I hate to ride. Now the neighbors, they all knew, they had seen him leave with you, but what they didn't see was I followed close behind. And the next day's paper read that a man had been found dead, and the lady he'd been seen with they can't find. And there's buried treasure hidden in the ground, precious memories of a love that lived and died. You couldn't be the simple wife, you had to be the cheap life, and you led me down a road I hate to ride. As I'm walking behind this plow, I keep turning over the past once filled you.
Normally, I don't like doing outright reruns on this show. However, I was talking with Andy this weekend, and it seems this particular topic has come up again on the internet with some people he's been talking to, and he feels this one should be run again because a lot of our new audience on All Nationalist Network hasn't heard it yet, and I agree this is something that needs to be covered.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Before I really get going on today's real politics material, I need to answer a question I was sent over Facebook. Comrade John, I am really sorry it took me so long to even see it. For the record, if one of you wants to talk to me, make sure your message is going to a place I'll actually see. I tend to ignore the other tab when I'm looking at Facebook messages, and John's question was buried there for a couple of months. Anyway, Comrade John asked, if the state of Nazi Germany had not been defeated in war, do you think it would have held together over time? Would the socialist elements have eventually agitated against the nationalist side, as in Rome and his essay? Do you think it would have allowed for stable transition of power from one leader to another? Are you aware that the Ba'ath Party of Iraq and Syria was modeled on the NSDAP? In those situations, the dear leader eventually outshined the party. Do you think the fact that there was no check or balance on the leader's power was a good thing or bad thing? It is a known fact that several military mistakes are directly attributed to Hitler. I'm interested in National Socialism, but am not quite ready to admit it is the greatest form of government ever. Ethnic nation-states ruled by hereditary monarchies did the lion's share of putting the white man on top back in the day. I'm actually in a unique position to answer this question. I myself am not a National Socialist, though some would say otherwise. During a routine party meeting, Mac once described me as an agnostic National Socialist, so do what you will with my response. Further, it's not at all the case that the Northwest Front pushes National Socialism or requires it of those interested in Northwest Nationalism. No one here advocates it as essential racial dogma. I don't perceive National Socialism to be racially unhealthy, and if the NAR ends up being a National Socialist state, that would be just fine with me. There are two separate parts to John's question, the second of which I'll take first. John, you made a number of very important observations about history and the leaders in it. Regardless of the government involved, mistakes are attributed to any and every leader. My first real politics talk actually went over the reality that America was almost a monarchy instead of the wrong-headed experiment the founding felons crafted. After that, I went on to point out, in practice, non-democratic forms of government tend to look the same since there's either one person or a very small group exercising a very large amount of power. This is true for any non-democratic system, be it National Socialism, hereditary monarchy, or some variety of oligarchy. In any of these systems, the people in charge will always be the main focus since they're the ones responsible for what ends up happening, not their parties, supporters, or peers. In reality, checks and balances will always exist in some way. Factions exist, and always will. Even in admittedly desirable monarchical systems, exchanges of power weren't always pleasant. So that concern is ever present in any type of government. Out of respect for John's concerns, I'm trying to stay objective. Even so, I have to point out that Adolf Hitler is criticized from all angles, especially in the movement. To be honest, this is all hindsight analysis, and in retrospect, everyone screws up. Always investigate and consider the past, but don't stress over these sorts of things since they'll always be. As for the first part of the question, I really don't see why National Socialism wouldn't have stuck around for a while. Sure, white people tend to organically create shiny new ideas and philosophies, so I'm sure it would have eventually been replaced by something else, but that's not exactly germane. It's true that varying factions exist in every environment, but socialists wouldn't have had much of a reason to agitate in Nazi Germany. There's no way every single person was happy, but that's just people for you. Nationalism and socialism aren't mutually exclusive. Remember, socialism isn't the same thing as communism, much to Rush Limbaugh's chagrin. Just look at the difference between the Weimar Republic and the Third Reich. National Socialism would have lasted since it was good for just about every last German. But why? Well, aside from the obvious racial angle, we need to consider economics. With an honest economic system, Germany was able to rise out of the disastrous state it was in and actually enable common people to enjoy what would have been high luxury in other European countries. You might say the National Socialist policies had a high ROI, or return on investment. Today's talk is about just that. In mid-December of last year, I did a housekeeping segment on RFN which has bearing on this subject. The party and I are regularly approached about a possible, though somewhat fanciful, Northwest agency, which would theoretically give substantial physical and financial assistance to those trying to come home. The trouble with this idea is that the party would only agree to expend resources on those we think to be a good investment. More specifically, the outlay of money in particular would cause the party to expect a good return on that outlay in the form of skills and services rendered by the migrants we would help with said money. That is, we would expect a good ROI. This is totally reasonable, since otherwise, we wasted precious resources. Just breaking even means we wasted the opportunity to use those resources in a better way. I can hear you all wondering what in the world this might have to do with real politics. Remember back to the RFN episode where I discussed the actual solution. That, or think back to the Northwest independence novels. For this purpose, I like A Distant Thunder because it covers some of the fictional party activity prior to the revolution itself. There's a particular strategy required to liberate colonial territory from a large occupying power. Everything the party does needs to align itself with that objective. But hang on now, don't any of you slack in listening, since this part is important. Prior to actually making a bid for independence, there are things which need to happen in order to support that bid. By the by, they're still technically legal, but that's neither here nor there. Anyhow, the return on investment of our legal activity must be the ability to execute and support the strategy which we've adopted. Now, short of you people actually coming home and helping the party, we can't actually do what we need to. However, it's still the case that we can waste our time and resources doing things we shouldn't do. And that's just as bad, because it actually results in a negative ROI. Now here's the thing. It would be dumb of the party to invest the manpower, time, and money required to relocate someone of T-shirt youth quality, because doing so is guaranteed to result in the total loss of that investment. That's a bad ROI. There's nothing but cost and risk, with no potential for a payoff of any sort. It wouldn't result in anything but a drain on the party, so it's not something we're going to do. Not only does it not further the work required to create a fighting white revolutionary party in the Pacific Northwest, it actually detracts from other things we need to accomplish in the interim. Now, with this base, I can make my point. There's another activity which white nationalists are prone to, even though it has an abysmal ROI. Harold has taken to calling this phenomenon streetwalking. And no, this isn't about prostitution. Public demonstrations are a white nationalist movement perennial favorite, but they're absolutely the wrong thing to do. Let's recap. There's only one solution to white genocide, and that's the Northwest American Republic. There's only one way to realize that solution. See the Northwest independence novels for details. Since that's the case, anything which either doesn't contribute to or detracts from it doesn't give us any return and is, therefore, the wrong thing to do. I'm going to wrap up today's talk analyzing the ROI of streetwalking. This has come up several times on RFN, but I want to try this approach to see if it's any more effective. Hey, I can dream, can't I? All right, so here's the deal with streetwalking. A few of us get the bug to run around and make idiots out of ourselves with a sign and possibly chanting something pithy because we feel the need to be brave and show the world what mighty white Power Rangers we are. Of course, there's the immediately obvious cost and risk involved. aside from the financial cost of whatever physical equipment, signs, funny costumes, and transportation is required, there's the immediate issue of one's identity being exposed to the world. There's also the less tangible risk of making white nationalists look bad, but I'll get there in a second. The one viable strategy we have available to us needs functional, reasoning adults who aren't all gummed up in society because their politics are known to the world at large. Exposing oneself not only puts you at risk, it puts your comrades around you at risk of exposure as well. Whatever you take away from my talk today, you do not, under any circumstances, have the right to make that choice for other people. Doing so comes desperately close to deliberately outing them yourself, and the party will take notice of it when it happens. Think on that for a bit. But enough about risk. What about the rewards? Well, there aren't any. Streetwalking and other public events do not assist the strategy required to create the Northwest American Republic. Mass demonstrations and political action aren't a part of the Butler Plan, so at best they're a wash. And remember, a wash is as good as a loss because it's missed opportunity to do something else. Let's figure the ROI on this. All risk and loss with no reward. Wait a minute, that's a terrible return. No, really, at best, the only thing to come of this is an emotional and possibly hormonal high, which is the real reason anyone ever does this. I get that many of you out there are really into this sort of thing, but it's just not helpful or relevant to what really needs to happen. And since I'm on the subject, don't try to sell me on the idea that this is brave. Bravery doesn't mean taking stupid risks for no payoff, so public activity doesn't entail any sort of bravery. It's stupidity, a little drunkenness, well, most of the time anyway, and perhaps a little roid rage if we're to believe stereotypes of white nationalists. Even if there were zero risk involved in streetwalking, it would still be useless because it doesn't play a role in the task we need to accomplish. Conversely, it's not cowardly to refuse to engage in dangerous activity when there's nothing to gain by it. I've said before that I used to do my fair share of public activity, but it wasn't related to racial politics. Further, when I did so, it was to stop specific events which were happening at specific times and places, and I was one of what was usually a very, very large number of people. I figured I'd better come clean since someone would call me on it if I didn't. Don't compare what I did with what goes on in white nationalism. The two are worlds apart. I would go into details, but it would be rude of me to go on longer. I know some of you are absolutely obsessed with public demonstrations, but please think back on what I said about obsession and enthusiasm. Actually think about what you're doing in the future. Your bad behavior will eventually cost you, and possibly someone else, very dearly, while buying your race absolutely nothing. Why throw your potential away like this when you could properly participate in the Northwest Imperative? Hail victory, comrades.
This is Narben der Gewalt. No relation, presumably, to Oi Gewalt. We'll be right back.
There is. You just gave me a segue into a point I wanted to make. What's happened to the Republican Party in this country and how it has been completely hijacked by dual Israeli citizens? The most notable example is Sheldon Adelson, who in this last election cycle put up $1 billion. He handpicked the members of the Senate and the House that he wanted to put in there. And I look at the Democrat Party, and it's never represented me. You know, most of the American people don't have a political party anymore, and we don't have a voice in what goes on around us. We've been completely shut out of this. There is no recourse for Americans. I mean, I don't care if you're black, white, brown, Asian, whatever. You have no recourse. The government does what it wants. We've become a country ruled by oligarchs, which I think is probably the worst of the worst forms of government ever. I'd rather have a benevolent dictator.
Well, remember the famous 2014 election where there was this big sweep for the Republicans, and they were promising, "Oh, yeah, if you put us in there, we'll take care of this Obama who just made himself a dictator and legalized all these illegal aliens. We'll put a stop to it." Yeah, they hadn't put a stop to Jack. The very first thing that the Republicans did in January 2015 when they came back from their Christmas break and they had their new Congress there, majority Republican, the very first thing they did was to take impeachment off the table. They said, "Well, no, we're not going to impeach," which is the only disciplinary
tool that they have.
The Constitution allows. Yeah. And the very first thing they said is, "Well, whatever we do, we're not going to impeach him," which is utter, complete, total betrayal of the people who just voted them into office. And the people just signed. I don't think they expected anything else. Nobody expects any of these big mouth Republicans to stick. The one thing that they have done, I've noticed, that it really has ticked Obama off and ticked the Democrats off. The one solid action that they do seem to be taking is to try and mess with him on this Iran deal, because that's what Israel wants. When Israel says run, the Republicans in Congress say how far. When Israel says jump,
they say how high. Yeah.
How high, yeah. And they really have taken after Obama over this Iran deal. They went so far as, okay, they invited Netanyahu to speak to Congress, which, okay,
I agree, is
a gross violation of protocol. It's without precedent in American history. And then they wrote round robin letter or something. They actually contacted a foreign government that the United States government was negotiating a treaty with and told that foreign government, by the way, whatever our president gives you, they're violating,
that's an act of treason.
Yeah, it is.
It's a violation of the Logan Act. And I don't know why Obama is sitting back and the Justice Department hasn't picked up the 47 senators who signed that thing and throw them in the jail. I mean, what the heck? If I did that, Harold, I'd be in jail so fast it'd make your head spin.
I think he's scared to actually, it's kind of a Mexican standoff. It's actually like in Ireland. Neither side wants what the other to dish out if they really feel like it. I think Obama knows if it actually got to the point where he was arresting Republicans and putting them in prison with blacks and Mexicans and druggies and that sort of stuff and making them live with the mess that they'd created in a prison cell, that would change the game, because all of a sudden then the Republicans would realize that they were in a majority and say, "Hey, this business of actually locking our asses up, that is definitely a violation of our little truce. And then, okay, fine, if you're going to do that, Barack, we really will impeach your ass. You want to play that way? We'll play that way." By the way, I would love to see that. But
anyway, the
thing is that it's like Lenin once said to his communist buddies and Bolsheviks in the Politburo or the Central Committee. He said, basically, "Have your arguments, have your debates, but let there be no blood between you." In other words, don't actually kill each other. And, of course, Stalin, when he took over, threw that rule out the window. I think there are still a few unspoken understandings in the Washington establishment, and one of them is that there will be no blood between them. No actual criminalizing of political differences, which, by the way, the Democrats violated first when they indicted Rick Perry for basically doing something which is entirely his constitutional right as governor of Texas to do, but they had a grand jury full of Democrats and Mexicans and whatnot and indicted the governor, the sitting governor, for basically doing his job. And then Obama, you may have noticed, the one Democrat that actually was, I guess, in his pocket, who supported the Republicans on the Iran thing, this guy Menendez, New Jersey, he stands up to Obama and makes unkind comments about Obama and his Iran deal in public, and all of a sudden he gets indicted.
Let me give you some background here, because I've got some intel on this. Menendez was indicted because of his relationship with the eye doctor who hasn't practiced medicine in 30 or 40 years. But the eye doctor is a direct business partner of Jeb Bush. And the Menendez indictment was a shot over the bow of Jeb Bush telling him to sit down, shut up, you're not running.
Okay,
so that's just a little intel for you there. That's something that you'll never see published. That's just how that is.
That's odd because I always figured that come till 2016, what we're going to get is Hillary versus Jeb Bush.
Yeah, so that's what it's looking like more every day. And you know what? The death for America. You know, this country cannot survive another Clinton or another Bush. They've both been abysmal failures.
Bush changed his voter registration to Hispanic.
Come on, that sounds kind of funny, actually. Maybe he's trying to get an affirmative action benefit or something. I don't know. But I've got a question from the chat room here for one of my regular listeners. Mark wanted me to ask you. He said that he's read your books and that your system seems to be very authoritarian. And where he wants to live, what he wants to do is maximum freedom for himself, individual mm-hmm. freedom. Can you offer some insight on that might clarify his perspective?
Okay, yes, I'm glad that question was asked because it is a problem that we've had theoretically since it got started, and it is also a problem that we're going to have in real life. Practically speaking, now let's assume that we come to power in some form and we create the Northwest American Republic in some form approximately similar to what I describe in my book. And this is where that fifth novel, Freedom Sons, comes in. It points out the fact that our new country is going to be surrounded by enemies. It is going to be sanctioned. The sanctions they've got on Iran are going to look like nothing. The United States will build, in the book I call it the McCurtain. It's like a fortified Berlin Wall around the entire country to try and keep white people out. They are going to try and strangle us in our cradle. They're going to try and cut off our economy and force us back, as I have one of my characters say in the book, we're going to force these people back to the horse and buggy and then we're going to starve the horse to death. We are going to be in a society that is surrounded by enemies. In that situation, the fact is, yes, there is probably going to have to be a certain amount, a large amount in some cases, of authoritarianism. I make no bones about the fact that any white homeland, the Northwest Republic or anything else, is going to have to be a very militaristic state. Again, a lot of people don't like this parallel, but consider what happened with Israel when Israel was first formed. They brought in a situation where everybody, including girls, got drafted, and that was the first time that had ever been done because they simply had to have the manpower. We're going to have the same thing. It's in our Constitution that young men, unless they are literally crippled to the point of being in a wheelchair, all go into the Army at the age of 18 or so, and they do 2 years in the service, and they do a number of years in the reserves,
Can I chime in on this? I think that's a wonderful policy. I think that should be mandatory in the USA. I think we should be doing that today. Everybody, you turn 18 years old, you got a 2-year stint in the military. Doesn't matter what branch, but you got a 2-year stint. You go serve your time. You learn some skills. You mature a little bit. You grow up. And then you start college, or then you start your career, or whatever it is you want to do.
That's like it was when I was growing up. I mean, I first bought my first beer and bought my first guns with a draft card I got. I registered 2 years early for the draft because it was an easy idea to get and show that I was 18. But the thing is that I actually was drafted when I was in basic training in the Army at Fort Polk. Every young man of my generation just assumed that you were going to get drafted. The thing is, in the 60s, especially with all the anti-Vietnam War crap, one of the things that the liberal elite did, and sorry to say the wealthy Republican elite did as well, they increased all these deferments so that basically with a little bit of shuffling and a little bit of the right connections, junior, you get to go to college and basically he would get out of being drafted. It was a privilege for the wealthy. By the time I came along, it was pretty well acknowledged that basically rich kids didn't get drafted. It's like that line in the Steve Earle song, Copperhead Road, address the white trash first round here anyway. And that was very much that. Now, in my case, I volunteered for the military. Of course, had no choice. My father threw me out of the house. But the system was breaking down then. And then when I was in the Army, they actually phased it out. Nixon abolished the draft. I was in the last basic and the last AIT that had any draftees in there. That was when they brought in what was called VOLAR, Volunteer Army. I have been expecting the Army to bring back the draft for many years now. It's in my books that they did, and it's the one sort of prophecy in my books that has not been fulfilled.
I don't think they will, and the reason they won't is they don't want to repeat Vietnam, where you've got all of America who says, no, you're not taking my son, you're not sending him over there to die.
Yeah,
and all of America's
daughters as well. But there's those of us who are old enough to remember the big Vietnam peace movement and the anti-war movement. It was not an anti-war movement. It was an anti-draft movement. The minute that Nixon abolished the draft, it all but disappeared. That was not when the war ended. Yeah, that's what a lot of people basically simply don't get about that whole Vietnam thing and the so-called peace movement. I remember in high school, we actually, this was done with the administration's approval, we actually had so-called counselors from various peace groups coming onto campus, and they had like little tables out in the foyer and whatnot, and you could sit down with one of these people, and they would counsel you and advise you on how to avoid the draft, I mean, break the law. And this was, of course, Chapel Hill was a very liberal school district, but that's one of the things I noticed that was wrong. It's one of the things that I think made me much more conservative. I mean, I was like 15, 16 years old, and I remember thinking, look, you guys do realize that this is breaking, you know, the law says we have to go and you're breaking the law and this is being done with the administration's approval here and these people are here counseling us how to break the law? What's going on here? It's one of the things that made me first start to ask questions as to why this dichotomy, this difference between what is said and what is done. I hate to be constantly quoting movies, but there's one movie which I won't get into, but the guy says so many people in our society fall into a chasm. Chasm between what is said and what is done. And that whole Vietnam thing demonstrated to me that there was and is a chasm in the United States between what is said and what is done. Basically, it's kind of like George Orwell said, Animal Farm, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. I first noticed this in high school, and that was the whole, you know, anti-Vietnam and lefty SDS thing was one of the things that pointed this out to me, and I am rambling here. Sorry about that.
No worries. And you know, we're getting ready for our next break, and we're going to take some callers in the next half hour, if that's okay with you, Harold.
Sure.
So I want to give out the dial-in number. It's 310-421-4053. So if anybody wants to dial in, ask Harold a question. The number is 310-421-4053. And we'll be right back with Harold Covington right after this short break. Good afternoon. Welcome back. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio. Today is Friday, April 10th, 2015. My guest today is Harold Covington, author and social commentator. Harold, welcome back, sir.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got our first caller. I think this is Bob.
Yes, it is. Good morning. How are you?
I am well, Bob. How are you?
Well, Harold, I really enjoyed your analysis of Northern Ireland, because I think the drift of everything is going to go that way down here in the heart of Atlan. There is a similar kind of a theme that follows your book, I mean, on the analysis of Northern Ireland, and it was the Turner Diaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
And I think that you really did a good job. However, there is a problem with moving to the Northwest, and that is Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the west coast of California is being now inundated with Fukushima's radiation. And that refers me and my own thinking back to a series of talks that was given by Dr. Day. And it's found in the writings called The Day of the Barbarians.
Mm-hmm.
And that is to do in the entire coastline and borders of the United States, turn them into third world, and then depopulate, and then work towards the middle of the United States.
Yeah. That may well be part of the enemy plan, which is another reason why our new homeland, wherever it is situated, has to have a coastline. I lived in Rhodesia as well during the 1970s, and I can tell you that it is not a good idea to live in a landlocked country that is heavily sanctioned by the outside world unless you have a lifeline of some kind, basically to the coast and to the outside world, which in our case it was through South Africa. But we can't allow that kind of situation to arise in this country. I'm aware of the Fukushima problem and the environmental problems that have been caused by all the various experimentation that liberal democracy has done down through the years. Look, guys, I want to make something clear. I do not claim that the Pacific Northwest is some kind of paradise or Big Rock Candy Mountain or land running with milk and honey or anything like that. It is not perfect. We have problems here. It is not as racially pure as I would like it. Not as racially pure as it was 20 years ago when I first came. And again, there are problems here. The city's very liberal. They have large non-white communities. This is not something that's just going to be handed to us on a silver platter. We're going to have to fight for it in every sense of the term. And I want everyone to understand, you're not coming to the land of milk and honey here. It's like the old days when you were landing on a barren shore in New England or Virginia. You're going to have to cut the forest and build your cabins and build your own communities. And it's going to be rough and done in the face of some resistance. But the fact is that the Pacific Northwest is still just about the best place that we can find. Actually, it's the whitest place remaining in the country, just about, except for certain parts of New England. And people have asked, well, Harold, why don't you have a migration to New Hampshire or Vermont or Maine or one of these? Well, I've noticed that those places, especially Maine, are no longer quite so white because the government is deliberately bringing in things like Somalis. Portland and Bangor, Maine now have a Somali gang problem that's also too small. There's not enough industry. Here in the Northwest, we have industry. We have natural resources. The Pacific Northwest is capable of becoming food independent. We can grow just about everything we need to eat here. We can feed ourselves in this land. The Pacific Northwest has room to grow into with the millions of refugees that are going to be coming here, and they will. The Pacific Northwest has a coastline which will allow us contact with the outside world. Look, it's not perfect here. It's simply the best we've got. There is also a moral and spiritual connection between our movement and the Pacific Northwest through the heroes of the order, through the murder of the Weaver family, through Gordon Call, so forth and so on. So the Pacific Northwest is not perfect. I am, like I say, aware of, among other things, the Fukushima problem that's going to be irradiating the seafood. And as a matter of fact, we have a friend of ours who makes it a point to keep up with that. All I can say is I have had people come to me with all kinds of strange reasons for not coming to the Pacific Northwest. One guy was afraid of volcanoes.
Now I don't know I don't know where I'm gonna go when the volcano blows. Let me say now.
And, yeah, he has a point. Mount Rainier and Mount Hood, and, of course, Mount St. Helens blew in 1980. And, yeah, we've got volcanoes up here.
I don't know where I'm gonna go when the volcano blows.
We had an earthquake here some about 20 years ago. And you can find an excuse not to do something in almost anything. Us white boys are really great at that. We are superb at finding excuses to do nothing and to continue with the status quo. But we're going to have to get out of that habit. I have been asking for many years, what is the alternative to the Pacific Northwest? To all you guys who say we're going to take back all of America, or you guys you want to set up enclaves in Illinois or Iowa or someplace like that, fine. What exactly is your plan? How will it work? Is there an alternative? And so far, nobody has really come up with one. The simple fact is, we in the Northwest Front have the plan. And I'm running off the mouth here. I believe you want to take some more calls.
No time to count what time worth, 'cause I just left the planet Earth. Where I go, I hope there's rum. Not to worry, monsoon come. Now I don't know. I don't know where I'm gonna go when the volcano blows. One more now.
Okay, I'm sorry. That bit about the volcanoes, every time I hear it, it just reduces me to hysterical rolling on the floor laughter. Volcanoes. Anyway, this is Makeham and Clancy.
It's of a brave young highwayman, this story we will tell. His name was Willie Brennan, and in Ireland he did dwell. 'Twas on the Kilworth Mountains he commenced his wild career, and many a wealthy noble land before him shook with fear. Oh, it's Brennan on the moor, all brave and undaunted was young Brennan on the moor. One day upon the highway, yes, Willie, he went down. He met the mayor of Cashel, a mile outside the town. The mayor, he knew his features, and he said, young man, said he, your name is Willie Brennan, you must come along with me. And it's Brennan on the moor, all brave and undaunted, was young Brennan on the moor. Oh, Brennan's wife had gone to
town provisions for to buy. And when she saw her Willie, she commenced to weep and cry. Said, hand me the tenpenny as soon as Willie spoke. She handed him a blunderbuss from underneath her cloak. For young Brennan on the moor, Brennan on the moor, all brave and undaunted was young Brennan on the moor.
Now with this loaded blunderbuss, the truth I will unfold. He made the mare to tremble, and he robbed him of his gold. £100 was offered for his apprehension there. So he went horse and saddle to the mountains did repair.
Did young Brennan on the moor, Brennan on the moor.
Okay, we're now over an hour. Damn, I missed that extra 8 to 12 minutes I could take back before we got syndicated. It made all the difference. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Well, they fought for poor old Ireland.